It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
This just in, you are looking at obviously a very disturbing live shot there. That is the World Trade Center, and we have unconfirmed reports this morning that a plane has crashed into one of the towers of the World Trade Center.
Yeah, now remember, oh my God.
That looks like a second plane.
As I just saw a plane go in. That just exploded.
I just saw another plane coming in from the side.
You did?
That's the second explosion. You could see the plane come in just from the right-hand side of the screen. So this looks like it is some sort of a concerted effort to attack the World Trade Center.
Did you see what happened?
Well, I was in the past train, and there was a huge explosion sound. Everyone came out. A large section of the building is blown out.
They are now saying that a plane, incredibly, has crashed into the Pentagon. Folks,
another aircraft, unbelievably, has crashed into the Pentagon. This is a preliminary wire. We seek to confirm this, but this word just into us from our newsroom that perhaps another aircraft went in there.
Sandy Rios with you. It's hard to believe. 19 years ago today, that's what happened. If you turned on your television in the morning hours around 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, I believe that's what you heard. And then our lives were consumed by that for the next many, many months. And actually, you could argue that our lives changed forever as a result of that day. I've asked my husband, Bruce, to join me to talk about this because actually we met not long after 9/11 in Washington. It's a date that for obvious reasons has tremendous meaning to both of us. But first of all, Bruce, thanks for joining me.
I'm glad to be here.
And, you know, give people a little bit idea, remind them, because, you know, it's been almost 20 years. So there are a lot of kids that and younger people who don't even know what happened on that day. Can you give us just a thumbnail sketch of what that was all about?
Yes. I was working for the FBI at the time, and I was on a surveillance, and I was living in Los Angeles, so I was working in Los Angeles, and so it was very early in the morning there. We started at 5:30, and at like 5:45 in the morning, while we were sitting there and we were surveilling an international terrorist subject, our boss called us and said, "Whatever you're doing, stop and come to the office right now." And he was a very low-key guy, so we knew something had to be up. And what was unusual for me is I was sort of in a very transitional way in my life. I had just put my house on the market that previous Friday. I was transferring from Los Angeles to Chicago. I was just kind of, you know, marking time that day. And normally I would have had what we call a personal radio or a good time radio where I could listen to news and things while we were on the surveillance. But my radio was broken in my car that day. So I had no idea what was happening. And our boss, when he told us to get in, we figured it's got to be really something.
So when you went on, and it was probably on television then, right?
It was. We by the time we got into the office, he had turned on the television. We had what they call an offsite, so it was undercover, but we did have a television. And when we went in there, here's the first plane had hit at about 5:45 our time, and by the time we got in there, the second plane was just hitting, which would have been about just after 6 a.m. our time, and you know, you just kind of knew our whole world is changing right now in front of us.
Just to review, just for a second, again, there were 19, most of them Saudi nationals, who mm-hmm. were terrorists, and they had all trained here in the United States on how to fly.
Right.
They had hijacked three different planes. Were there
four.
More? There were four planes.
Mm-hmm.
And So one of them, of course, hit the Pentagon. One of them went down in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. That's where the graduate of Wheaton College, Todd Beamer, from all accounts, was the one that led the charge to take down the hijacker. So wherever they were going to land, there's been speculation about the White House being their destination. They did not make it, and they went down in that field. And then the third, the other two planes hit the World Trade Center in New York City, and almost 3,000 people were killed.
Right.
Yeah, so at that time, Bruce, do you remember watching the actual, those planes actually go into the World Trade Centers? Do you remember the moment that you saw that for the first time? Or
it was like one of those surreal things that you, in my mind, I just could hardly wrap my mind around it. I mean, the first one, you know, you wondered, well, I'm not sure. Is this just an accident or what? But when that second one hit on the South Tower, you knew this is war. And you know, are we in jihad? Of course, you don't know who did it at that point.
No, you don't have...
You don't know what kind of adversary are we facing here? And is this going to escalate?
Right.
You know, are we talking nuclear? What are we talking at this point?
Right. The interesting thing, you and I had not met yet, and I was a long way away. I was actually, I was on radio in Chicago. That was my job. But physically, I was in North Korea the day that happened. We were on a trip to China and talking to people who were hiding, really, in northern Manchuria from the Chinese authorities who had escaped from North Korea. And we ended up at the last minute, we were invited. They made a way, which is, don't ask me to explain it because I still can't. Six of us were able to get into North Korea. And so because they were so shut off, you know, North Korea, it's hard to comprehend. But we knew nothing. We heard nothing about it. And for 24 hours, we knew nothing. We were cut off from the world. And when we came back across the border, across the Tumon River, on the morning of the 12th, well, actually, it was the evening, we went to a Chinese restaurant in northern Manchuria. And the owner there, through an interpreter, said, "Do you all know, you're Americans, right?" "Yes, we're Americans." We'd sat down. We'd already ordered our meal. And he said, "Well, do you know what happened?" And through the interpreter, he told us. And personally, I thought he was crazy. I thought, I asked someone, I said, "Is this man sane? Is he crazy?" And we were six talk show hosts from various large cities. One was from New York City. And so he had a satellite phone and he called his wife in New York City and she confirmed everything. And we, of course, could not eat. We were just beside ourselves, took our food and went to our host's home, which was in the dark. We climbed up the steps to the top floor of this apartment building, went into the apartment, and they turned CNN International on, which was coming to them in Korean, or Chinese, I guess it was Chinese. And we watched those bodies fall from the towers. And I'll never forget that either, Bruce, because what I thought was, both my children were back in the States. And I remember just being on my knees on the floor of that apartment, just rocking back and forth. I thought, I may never see my kids again. Yeah. This may be the beginning of a war. What is this, just the first strike? You know, what's going to happen? And when will I ever get back home again? If I will ever get, we didn't even know if the Chinese would not, whoever had attacked us would co-opt the Chinese and we would be stranded forever.
You didn't know who had committed the act. It could have, you know, I know it might be politically incorrect, but it might have been the Chinese in your mind at that time.
Sure.
You don't know who it was. It's like, it was kind of like Pearl Harbor. We're being attacked out of the blue.
Yes.
Who knew what was happening?
It's before, you know, no one had ever heard of Islamophobia or, you know, we knew very little about Islam. We didn't know how to pronounce names from the Middle East. And not that we hadn't had experience. I mean, the first World Trade Center bombing had taken place. Andy McCarthy, who's a good friend and has been my guest so many times, was the prosecutor of the Blind Sheikh in that case. That happened in the 90s. But still, on the spectrum of things, that wasn't anything like this.
Right.
Which had such broad scope and such a traumatic effect.
Yeah, the attack on the USS Cole was probably the closest thing we'd had to this. But in comparison, and I don't mean to diminish that, but in comparison, that was a small event compared to what was going on 9/11.
We'd had hijackings of airliners. We'd had that attack in 76 at the Olympic Games. So we knew that Islam was, well, they liked killing people. At least many of them did. But that's really all we knew. And so it has radically changed us forever in that regard. In fact, let's talk about that. Bruce, you always talk about how that changed the Bureau.
Oh, it turned us on our head. Director Mueller had literally been the director, I think, 5 days when 9/11 happened. I mean, he doesn't even know how to find his office hardly, and he's hit with 9/11. And we went from a reactive criminal investigatory agency into much more of an intelligence-driven, collecting information type organization. I think it was a terrible fit, actually, but that's what happened to us. And the government actually considered splitting the FBI in half and making half of it an intelligence agency and leaving the other half as a criminal agency, but that did not happen. In fact, the orders were on George Bush's desk, and he decided not to sign them.
So instead, they established a whole new agency, the Homeland Security,
right,
which is brand new. That was a response to 9/11.
Right.
You know, the way I see one of the changes that I saw, I just won't ever forget. We ended up back in Beijing at a Holiday Inn, beautiful Holiday Inn, actually. But we were stranded there for, I think, 10 days, 2 weeks, and ended up having to come back through Tokyo, which is another story. But every night I would turn on CNN and watch what was happening in America during the day, because there's 12 hours difference. And we stayed up watching. I remember I was watching CNN, and I saw the anchor, whoever it was, might have been Wolf Blitzer, turning to a pastor on the set with him and asking him to pray. I was stunned. And you know, we weren't in the States to feel what you guys were feeling and experience what you were experiencing. I thought the whole world has changed.
Yeah.
In 24 hours here, the whole world has changed. And we saw people praying in New York City along the way and the steps as people were escaping, you know. And I thought it was going to be a spiritual revival. It sure seemed that way. The churches were filled for a time. But it didn't turn out that way, did it, Bruce?
No, it didn't. I think the original reaction was the old, there's no atheists in foxholes, and we're under attack. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, whether you think you believe in God or not, I think you all of a sudden think, I need help from a higher power than what I have. But like anything, it faded. It's amazing to me. Like, I just heard today that people that are enlisting to go overseas in the military were not even born on 9/11 because it's 19 years ago. And that's kind of hard to fathom. But what's even harder for me to fathom is the way people have forgotten about 9/11.
Yeah.
I mean, I just, when I look at what we're cowering from now compared to what we were, you know.
We're so much weaker than we were then. I mean, like, so. Well, I can't use the word that comes to my mind. Let's see.
Yeah.
We become very girly.
Yeah.
We've just lost our fight, at least a lot of it. You know, the other big change, Bruce, and I had a front row seat to this, is the Muslim Brotherhood. I went to D.C. 1 month after 9/11. That's when I moved there. I was in transition when I was in North Korea. I hadn't even told anyone in Chicago. I was going to Washington, D.C. to be the president of Concerned Women for America, but I had a front row seat to what happened next. And that's when I started doing tons of television and having to argue all of these things. And I know that the Muslim Brotherhood went into hyperdrive and sent a lot of Muslim Brotherhood brothers into the White House. President Bush was filmed with them, and they went into hyperdrive to propagandize the Americans that were suspicious of Muslims, had a bad feeling about them because of 9/11, we were Islamophobic. And that was the beginning of that whole deception, which stays with us to this day. So the world has changed in 19 years. And you and I met shortly after that, and that changed too, didn't it, sweetheart?
Yes, it did.
Yeah, so we are forever bonded on that particular major event in American history and really in world history. Honey, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
Memory.
Yeah. My pleasure.
Those of you who...
And really... remember 9/11.
Yeah.
It's important.
Yeah, you know, with your kids, watch stuff. There's going to be a lot of really good specials on various cable networks. Watch them so your kids will understand the battle that we face. And maybe this time, maybe we can have some true repentance in this country that will last. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
It's going to be a complicated, difficult, and challenging situation.
Remember the hanging Chad fight? Was that a vote or not? Expect a similar battle this year over mail-in ballots. Does the signature match the driver's license? Is there a postmark? When was the ballot mailed? Does the envelope display a complete signature, not initials? And is the ballot ripped or torn?
If every state were to try to switch over right now to vote by mail, it would be extremely challenging.
A survey by National Public Radio found 30 states rejected more than 500,000 mail-in ballots in this year's primary as non-conforming.
You not only have to sign it, but you have to fill in your name, your registered address. They may ask for the last four digits of your social security number, et cetera. And if you don't meet that compliance standard, your ballot's not going to get counted.
Officials in eight battleground states rejected 125,000 ballots. Wisconsin denied as many votes as President Trump's 2016 margin of victory there. In New York's primary, officials rejected 12,000 votes in a congressional race won by fewer than 4,000.
Though we're expanding vote by mail, and that's a very good thing, we need to offer more choices to voters.
Some first-time mail-in voters make innocent mistakes involving envelopes, deadlines, and signatures. And state officials say many don't have the capacity, training, or protocols to handle the volume.
I'm really glad that the president is helping open up these questions so that we can help voters understand the security and the verifiability and the accountability of our system.
For the most part, Republicans want strict rules to limit mail-in voting. Democrats want few constraints, citing studies showing young and minority ballots are more likely to be judged non-conforming. With November's projected margin of victory small in some states, both parties are educating their bases on how to properly fill out a ballot and mail it early.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. That was William LaJeunesse a couple of days ago, and he was talking about the potential fraud for mail-in balloting. We've talked about that almost every day, and I've encouraged you almost every day. Please vote in person. Don't be afraid of COVID. Go to your polls and vote in person. I don't think it's smart to send your ballot. I'll make my case again. We just heard this week that massive bags of mail were mysteriously dumped in Southern California, and one of those dumps was caught on camera by a person from a salon who was watching. We also know that there's another story out of California that a Trump supporter claimed that her postal worker defaced her mail by writing BLM on it and then actually throwing her mail on the ground instead of putting it in the box. We have an interesting story that I shared with you not long ago, confessions of a voter fraud. I was a master at fixing mail-in ballots. And we've talked about all the ways that you can be defrauded on that. And I think that's been kind of a central focus of our concern about the elections of 2020. Becoming twisted and fraudulent, and a way for the Democrats and the left, I would say, primarily stealing the 2020 election. But my next guest has a little different take on this, and I think it's fascinating. Chris Farrell has written an article called "How to Steal an Election" that really doesn't have anything to do with mail-in ballots. Chris has been our guest before; he's a good friend. He is a former counterintelligence officer. He also has been with Judicial Watch for about 20 years as the director of investigations and research. And that says a lot about the kind of work that Chris does already. Chris, thanks for joining us this morning.
Great to be with you, Sandy. Thank you.
You guys, let me just for a second before we get into this project that you've been writing about. Judicial Watch has really been all over other areas of voter fraud, like voter lists, right? You want to say something about that?
Sure. We've successfully litigated cases in places like California, Kentucky, Ohio, Indiana, and we have forced local officials through lawsuits and court victories. We have forced local officials to clean up voter rolls. And I think the most astounding one, it's not the most recent, but it's the most astounding one, is that in Los Angeles County alone, in that county, we have forced the removal of 1.5 million phony names on the voter rolls.
That's huge. I mean, that is just huge, even for California.
1.5 million votes in one county alone in California.
Yeah. Well, and isn't it also true, I don't know, I'm asking you questions off the cuff here, but I read that you guys had found tons of counties and districts and places in this country where there are way more people on the voter list than actually live in the county or that actually registered voters.
That's correct. And that's we did a very simple test. We took census data, and we matched up the census data against the voting registration data. And there's places that have, you know, 115% more people registered to vote than are even, you know, not even getting into the details, just looking at over 18 residents, right? That doesn't mean that the resident is eligible to vote, but usually they are. But, you know, just doing a straight population versus registration comparison, we found all sorts of wild disparities.
Yeah, so that's something. And of course, not the least of which, that election commission that President Trump assigned right after 2016 when he was elected was, you know, a couple of friends of ours, Hans von Spakovsky and Christian Adams, and also the former Secretary of State, Chris Kobach, and others. And they were just mercilessly hounded and put out of business by the left early on. And they're part of their...
And stonewalled by officials who were afraid to reveal and expose just how grossly corrupt and incompetent they were.
Yeah. So, bottom line is, you guys have done a great job of forcing some states like California to clean up their voter rolls, but there are a whole lot more states that haven't done that and actually do have more people on their voter rolls than they have people who are eligible to vote, and maybe even the citizens in the county. So we, Houston, we have a problem, I guess you could say. But along comes this other entity, and I read about this a few days ago, Chris, but I didn't really comprehend the way you have written about it. And so I wanted to talk to you because you come at this as a former intelligence officer, and you give us some insights that I didn't have. And you talk about this project called the Transition Integrity Project. And that's so ethereal that people say, well, what does that got to do with me or anything that I want to know about? Tell us, first of all, it will have something to do with your life. But what was the Transition Integrity Project? It was just released a few days ago.
That's a group of Democratic political operatives, people like John Podesta. There's a handful of others, but just sort of that character and of that ilk. Operators like John Podesta, and then a handful of sort of the crazed, you know, foaming at the mouth, never Trumpers, the failed magazine editor, Bill Kristol, among others, Mr. Frum, another, you know, sort of person who just can't accept reality, Michael Steele, the former RNC director. So there's a handful of you had to get disgruntled Never Trumpers to join their team so that they could claim to be bipartisan.
You know, let me just say, first of all, let me underscore something you said. You're talking about, now, the name Rosa Brooks wouldn't be so familiar to people, but she's a Georgetown law professor.
Correct.
And John Podesta, though, his name is familiar. He was the campaign manager for Hillary Clinton. And I think, you know, John is kind of like the behind the scenes, correct me if you disagree, but he, through his think tank,
Center for American Progress.
Thank you. I always think of him as like the idea person behind the left. In other words, they're the think tank that develops the position papers, that does the thinking and thinking ahead about how to scheme and plan. Am I overstating
Correct.
His role?
No. That's a very accurate description. He's sort of the strategic master, the thinker and the planner, and then he sends out munchkins to go do his bidding.
Yeah. So John Podesta then, now I want to reiterate this, partnering with the former RNC chair, Michael Steele, the journalist who describes himself as a conservative, I think he writes for the Washington Post or the New York Times, David Frum, and then, of course, Bill Kristol, who used to be so highly thought of by so many of us. But let's actually talk about what this Transition Integrity Project is doing, and then let's come back to those guys if we could. All right, so there it's like this group, and they're like wargaming. Now, explain to us, Mr. Intelligence Officer, what's wargaming?
Well, it's just an exercise in strategy. So they come up with scenarios, and they run through all the probabilities and sort of the, well, if this happens, then we're going to do that. And if then that happens, then we're going to do this. And so it's just working through a series of like options or possibilities, contingencies, and trying to come up with a strategy or a course of action that answers or that satisfies what your desired outcome is. And so, you know, if Trump wins Virginia, you know, what does that say about election night. And I mean, it's a lot of what if kind of literally war game. You know, what happens if they win this fifth state and they lose that state, and then, you know, this happens or that happens, what the electoral count is. It's all the what if kind of stuff.
Yeah. Let me give the four choices that they kind of posed, because I think this is interesting. Okay, so what would happen if President, I'm not asking you the question, I'm just going to tell people what the four things are, but what happens if President Trump wins decisively? What happens if Joe Biden wins decisively? What happens if Joe Biden just barely wins? What happens if there is a period of extended uncertainty after the election? And but they were something in common, you pointed out, with all of the what-ifs, the things that they gamed out, the common theme, they had a common theme, right? No matter which scenario, way it went, they said this thing would happen, right?
Right, and so their conclusion, no matter which way you run it, their answer is street violence and political impasse. So they are sitting there telling themselves stories, little fairy tales, and no matter which way they sit there and talk to themselves over and over again, they come to the same conclusion no matter what. And they are slowly but surely rationalizing, talking themselves into a violent outcome at the end of the election. And they're rationalizing it. They're trying to get themselves, and frankly, they're trying to get the news media, and they're trying to get the American public used to the idea, to make it palatable, to make it acceptable that no matter what happens on election night, there's going to be a violent reaction in the streets of America.
You know, you and I have talked so often, Chris, about Russia, Russian collusion and all of that. Now, I remember the very first time I heard that Russia was interfering with our elections, and it was the Jay Johnson under Barack Obama. He was on TV one afternoon. I just happened to catch it, and he dropped in the fact that the Russians were probably, this is the first my ears had heard this, the Russians were probably going to be, you know, sabotaging, interfering with the election. And it was such an odd statement at that time, completely out of context. And then he also went on to talk about nationalizing the elections in the same breath, the need to, which, as we know, elections are controlled by local entities, and that's safer than having the feds control all the elections. So I knew, because I know the left, I've been around a long time, that they always signal, they get you ready for what they're going to do. So that's what you say they're doing in this paper, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, they are telegraphing in very explicit terms that they're going to have street violence, that there's going to be violent protests, threats against both property and lives, that there'll be retaliation against people. They are talking themselves into true violent revolutionary activity in response to a presidential election.
You know what's interesting? Because this morning I was reading another piece on the potential stealing of the election, and this was a piece that WorldNet Daily has put out. But this is interesting. They report media outlets kind of breaking ground for us, getting us ready. You know, this reminds me of, this is a terrible illustration, but pedophiles kind of softening children by showing them pictures. It reminds me like they're breaking the ground. They're just getting you ready. They just want to, you know, kind of go ahead of what's actually going to happen to make sure that you can receive it because it's already been mentioned. And so just to illustrate that, Chris, the Washington Monthly had a story that was headlined, "How Trump Will Try to Steal the Election. If Voter Suppression and Foreign Influence Don't Work, He'll Contest the Results." And then the Atlantic wrote, "How Donald Trump Could Steal the Election," and says, "The president can't simply cancel the fall balloting, but his state-level allies could still deliver a second term." And The Guardian said, "It's all rigged. Trump foreshadows how he could undermine presidential election." And sorry, I'm going to go on. Let me just hammer it home. The Salon said, "Here's how Trump will steal the 2020 election. The Republican Party has refined its strategy of voter suppression, voter intimidation, and vote theft in elections across the country." And the last one, the Daily Beast, "This is how Republicans steal an election and maybe kill some Dems in the process." What are they doing?
Synchronized messaging. you know, part of it is propaganda. Part of it is, frankly, it's psychological conditioning. This is an information warfare technique that is used overseas, you know, in places where we're trying to influence our opponents, or we're attempting to, you know, sway a local population to support or to reject a government. And so the American population is now being psychologically conditioned, and it's being manipulated through both the news media and social media. And they have a synchronized message, and, you know, the headlines that you read from those four or five articles are all essentially the same.
Chris,
so they just keep pounding and repeating each other over and over again.
Yeah, and the theme in those was they are accusing the president of doing what exactly it is that they plan to do. Maybe we can make that point more clearly on the other side. My guest is Chris Farrell. His article, by the way, is called How to Steal an Election, and we will put that on our Facebook page because I think you'll want to read this. We won't be able to get to everything in it, but this is something you need to read and share. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
All right, so that's become the familiar refrain around the country. And along with that chanting has come harassment of people in public places, violence against them. We've had violence in front of the White House. We've had the attempted burning down of St. John's Church right across from the White House. We've had problems in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Portland, Oregon, and Salem, Oregon, and Seattle, and Los Angeles and New York City and Chicago, and you know the drill. We've had violence break out everywhere. And so now we have this Transition Integrity Project, which is a projection of what's going to happen regardless of the outcome of the 2020 presidential election. And the projection for them is that there will be terror and street violence no matter what happens. Kamala Harris herself said just she said that what you see on the streets, that's good, and it needs to continue. So Chris Farrell is my guest, and he's written this piece called How to Steal an Election, which is on our Facebook page. But, Chris, why do you think they predict violence no matter what the outcome? Seriously, why would that be? I don't understand that. I can understand that if Trump wins, but why violence if Joe Biden wins?
Because they're involved in a revolution. They are going to take the promise of Barack Obama, which is to fundamentally transform America. And certainly Obama did an enormous amount of damage, sliding us, you know, towards being a socialized failed state. That was his goal, and he had tremendous success in that regard. A lot of reversals happened under Trump, but now they're going to drive a stake through the heart of the country. And they're going to push this over into a radical revolutionary change to how the government operates. They're going to take the Constitution and twist it and pervert it into something you wouldn't even recognize. And the only way you can do that is through violence, intimidation, reprisal, threats. They have to terrorize the country. And they know that most Americans don't subscribe to that kind of lunacy. And they just want to take care of their families and go to work and pay the bills and kind of move along. But we've seen over and over again in history how a very militant, small, dedicated cell can seize control. And it certainly was the case of the Bolsheviks. And that's their goal. That's their model. That's what they want.
You know, Paul Kinger, the professor at Grove City, just wrote a piece last week about how it actually is Marx's teaching. And if you can control, I forgot the numbers, 1%, I think it was, of a group or entity, if you can control, if you can get in and infiltrate, you can control the other 99%, because most people are compliant, sure, and they're not violent, yeah, like the 1% they're willing to be. The question I...
Look at all the people that sat home under COVID-19 and people wandering around. There's people driving in their own cars with their windows up in the middle of nowhere with a face mask on. Right?
Yes, I've
seen
that myself.
They've been brainwashed into submission.
We saw a guy in a convertible with the top down by himself with a mask on driving. Yeah, people have gone out of their minds. People have gone out of, yeah, their minds, and they think they're doing, yeah, something noble. But yeah, we're getting... Let's come back to this. I wanted to ask you, just to speculate with me. I have to say, the three Republicans listed here that have cooperated with this war gaming strategy are the former RNC chair, Michael Steele, David Frum, who, again, identifies himself as a conservative. I think he writes for the New York Times, and Bill Kristol, who used to be so, and all three of them I know, and I'm sure you do too. I've spent time with them. I've interviewed them. I used to have great respect for them. Why in the world would they work with John Podesta, the king of revolution and undermining the country? Marxism, really? He doesn't say that, but that's what it is. Why would they cooperate to do this with those, with John Podesta and the rest of them?
Well, I don't know for certain. I can speculate and I can guess. And my personal opinion is that they were paid to do it, right? All three of them are essentially professional failures. And they've been largely excluded and marginalized. That has to have a financial impact in one way, shape, or form. And so somebody has come along with a checkbook and said, look, if we can use your name and we can call this revolutionary committee, if we can call it bipartisan by pointing at you, that's helpful to us. And all you have to do is cooperate and take this check. And so that may be, I don't know that as a fact, but that may be the way in which they got involved in this.
Yeah, that would actually make sense. The other part of it is, to me, I think of that Marxist term, useful idiots. You know,
I could be totally wrong, and it could be the opposite. It could be that they are just ideologically, you know, so bruised by Trump world that they'll do anything to be relevant.
You know, you mentioned, I talk about this. I used to talk about this a lot. When I first started on radio, Chris, in Chicago, I was a lot younger than I am now. And there were a lot of things I had to learn. And one of them was at the time we had three major networks. We didn't have so much cable news. And I remember, you know, I asked myself, why is it that every morning when you wake up, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the others all have the same headlines? And why is it when you listen to the network news on all three networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, they lead with the same story? Then they have the second same story. How is that? Who organizes that? How can that possibly be? Of all the stories in the world, this is the most important story, and everybody's come to that same conclusion? And then I was instructed that they all read the New York Times, and the New York Times is kind of leads the way, and they follow it, and they repeat what the New York Times thinks is most important. And so my point is this. You say that this Transition Integrity Project paper, the 22-page report, is an organizing tool, a signal tool for all of those operatives out in the field, a way for them to coordinate. Can you kind of explain that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the irony is they write about how to prevent disruption of the presidential election, but the entire body of the work talks about how they're going to disrupt the presidential election. That's part of the projection. And it's a public document, so it synchronizes the street operatives, the activists, and the true believers. It also gives people in the phony journalists who supposedly belong to our news media, it gives them sort of acceptable language to use. It gives them talking points. And then, you know, the millions and millions of, I don't participate in social media. I consider it to be an enormous waste of time. And so there's a ton of what I call babblers out there, people who are just incessantly prattling on about all sorts of things about which they know nothing. On social media, and they're all repeating and posting and reposting and tweeting and all the other nonsense they do. But that has an influence, right? That has an effect on a ton of people who actually believe that, you know, Twitter is something real. And so they all get the same, they all get spoon-fed the same sort of, you know, mental food, and they all process it the same way.
Yeah. And regurgitate it and repeat it. I mean, that is really what they do. I mean, it's amazing.
Exactly.
You know, I find most of the evening news now, so much of it now, is so blatantly repeating what another one of their, and I used to be, you know, on the news a lot. I mean, not the news, but opinion. I worked for Fox for a long time. So we share our opinions, but I find them sharing what somebody else tweeted and somebody else said. It's all about, it truly is an echo chamber. I mean, I know that's not an original thought in my head, but they really do just echo back to each other and repeat and repeat, and it bounces off the walls. But that this is dangerous. This is dangerous because they are signaling. So America's media is following suit already. They're talking about now how, and of course, the spokespersons on the left, Al Gore even said the other day that President Trump is not going to, he's not going to leave the White House. We'll have to send, you know, troops in to drag him out. They've mentioned, so many people have mentioned that. That's another case of signaling or laying the groundwork, don't you think, Chris?
It is. And frankly, some of it's just their wildest fantasies. You know, I guess they find some sort of mental pleasure in just repeating this nonsense. And, you know, the other thing is, this is an attempt to trivialize and to sensationalize and mock the president, which is all Saul Alinsky tactics, right?
Yes.
You take your opponent and you turn him into a cartoon character, and then you mock him incessantly. And that's Alinsky 101, and this is just more of that.
One other aspect of this, which makes tons of sense, you say that they are, through this treatise, co-opting Washington, D.C. federal bureaucracies to support their strategy from the headquarters of every department and agency and the executive of the executive. Boy, that's true. I mean, I don't know about this paper doing that. I haven't seen that yet. But that is true. There's just, the resistance is enormous. And you do wonder, you know, where do they get their marching orders? I guess it's from a paper like this, isn't it?
It is. And look, there's all these smug little bureaucrats who are burrowed into the federal government, build the headquarters, you know, agencies and departments around Washington, D.C. Well, you know, they all go home at night to Montgomery County, Maryland, and Arlington, Virginia. And if you look at the voting demographics from those two counties alone, you know, they're up in the 95%, you know, Hillary Clinton land. That's who goes into the office every day and mans all these agencies and departments. These people in these agencies and departments, these staffers at all the headquarters elements of these departments, they hate Trump. They loathe him. So, you know, the president is sitting on top of this bureaucracy, and the headquarters element, at least, here in Washington, D.C., pick an agency, pick a department. You know, probably 95% of the staff can't stand the president. They don't want to do anything to support him. Yeah. So when the bureaucracy starts to turn on the elected president, you know, now we wonder why, you know, there's resistance and there's the deep state and there's all sorts of shenanigans and leaks. It's very obvious.
You know, Chris, one of the most upsetting things that happened from my perspective during this last 6 months of riots and civil disobedience is when the president, when police and federal officers cleared out the square in front of the White House and the president walked across to go to St. John's and hold up the Bible after St. John's, they tried to burn it down. The general, whose name escapes me, but the general who was with the president actually making a statement saying, oh, he didn't know the president was going to do that. You know, and he can think that, but it works for the commander in chief. It, to me, the disrespect that he showed his commander in chief was frightening to me. And the undermining of President Trump using National Guard troops. A lot of military people were speaking up saying, oh, he can't do that. I think that neutralized the president to some extent in terms of his response to the violence. I'd like to hear your thoughts, Arvind.
Just keep in mind, all the general officers who are currently occupying senior positions are all creatures of 8 years of the Obama administration, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They all passed the litmus test of crazy stuff like, you know, transgendered soldiers, right? They didn't pop their heads up and say, Excuse me, Mr. President. We're a military force whose job is to identify, close with, and destroy the enemy. We're not interested in your social engineering and psychosexual laboratory experiments. That's not what we do. None of them did that, okay? They all rolled over and played dead and were, you know, little puppets for whatever the Obama administration wanted to do.
Yep.
So that's the leadership. That's the flag officers within the Department of Defense right now.
Very dangerous.
And so
that gives you
perspective on their level of courage.
30 seconds. Such and so unfair. But is there anything we can do to stop this? Anything? Can it be stopped?
Get out and vote and know what the rules are in your county and your state, and be a poll watcher. And when you see games and shenanigans being played, invoke all the lawful rules to stop it.
You sound like Sandy Rios. I almost every day for the last week or so, I've begged people to call their county office and to get hired to work in the polls. So let this serve as yet one more way. We are begging you, encouraging you to do that. That is something that you can actually do to stop this. Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch, the article is called How to Steal an Election. It's available on our Facebook page. Thank you so much. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.